Radio MD. RadioMD.com.
He's a cardiologist. He's a chef. He's America's culinary interventionalist. It's time for Code Delicious with Dr. Michael Fenster.
Hello, Food Nation, Healthy Nation. Are you ready for the scrumptious and the salubrious all wrapped up into one prosciutto covered tasty treat? I know that you are, and I know that you know. That means it's time once again for another Code Delicious, but not just another episode of Code Delicious. It's time for culinary CPR, and that means Chef Luca's in the house. Actually, in the pantry, he's waiting on us, getting all the ingredients together. We've got a full program today. You know Chef Luca. He runs the award-winning restaurant, Chef Luca's Mediterranean Cafe in Keene, New Hampshire. If you're in the neighborhood, you definitely want to stop by, check that out. If you're not, it's worth the trip. Trust me on this. He's also dominated on Food Network. Check him out, kicking butt on Guy's Grocery Games. And the list goes on and on. But I want to get right to the recipes today because we're going to share a recipe. And what you don't know about Chef Luca is that he's not only an amazing chef, he's just really an amazing guy. I mean, really, I am honored to call him my friend. And he does all this incredible charitable work that a lot of times just goes under the radar. And he's very active in his community. And one of the things that he's doing that I'm delighted to be part of this year is raising money, charitable money, and he does it through a competition, a Top Chef competition. This year's it's going to be Doctors versus Nurses. I'm delighted to be part of that on November 16th in Keene. And, you know, what I'm thinking, Chef, is, you know, this would make what we're going to share today, you know, we're really, if folks, the nurses or doctors, listen to the Code Delicious program, the Culinary CPR, they could really get a heads up on some things they could do. And the dish you're sharing today, ma'am, somebody does this for an entree, it might just hands down be the winner. What do you think?
Oh, I think this is quite possibly one of my favorite dishes of all time. I think I live for this dish whenever I see it on a menu. We are actually presenting it all this week and next week at the restaurant. And, you know, when I knew I was coming onto your show, I said, oh, I'm just going to tell them about this dish. Maybe it'll get you out here even sooner. So veal chop valdostana, it's a traditional Italian dish. Now, I'll give you a little background on Italian dishes and how they're named. I get that all the time. My waitstaff will always ask me, so where's that name come from? You know, caprese salad, this salad, Sorrentino. So the Italians are notorious for naming things after the cities that were almost the original invention of it sometimes. You know, it's been changes so much when it goes from town to town or grandmother to grandmother. But a lot of the dishes, when you talk about Valdostana, there's a region of Italy, Valdosta, and this is where it apparently originated in, so there's a lot more information there. You know, Bolognese comes from Bologna. So there's a lot of things you could think of. The insalata caprese, originally from the island of Capri, and mozzarella and tomato, look, it's easy enough to figure that out, too. So that's where the idea comes from. It's any type of protein with prosciutto and fontina cheese. That's the way we're going to start it.
Well, I want to say, because you brought up a great point, and I think a lot of people, you know, we tend to think of Italian food. I know you and I have talked about this a lot, and we sort of have kind of because of the Italian-American influence, culinary influence in particular in this country, we tend to think sort of very homogeneous, I think, often about Italian food. But and when we go in history, we learn about, you know, the Romans, which obviously the Roman influence was everywhere, and they conquered the entire sort of peninsula there. But you know, Italy really was, and particularly in the Middle Ages, a lot of small walled towns and cities. Yes. And after the fall of the Roman Empire, it wasn't a kingdom again until the 1800s. Right. So you have this sort of very tribal, very regional, very territorial pride in certain, you know, I think produce or products and dishes. And I think that's where a lot of this comes from. Am I extrapolating that correctly?
Then that's exactly it. I mean, one of the things that you find out when you do some research on Italian food, when you get past the idea of spaghetti and meatballs and pizza and lasagna, is that the idea of regional cooking in Italy is affected, and you know this, from all the books you've written and all the research you've done, in anywhere of the world, the regionalness of food is affected by the history, what's available there, the climate, of course, but also who has been there, whether they've conquered, whether they've assimilated to that part of the culture or what have you. You know, you'll see that a lot with southern Spain. A lot of their influences have this Moorish kind of influence to it. You'll see that in Sicily as well. Sicily, although, you know, depending on which Italian you talk to, it's not really part of Italy, but it kind of is. But Sicily, who was invaded so many times by different groups and has seen so much, has been influenced by so much, their culinary world is very different than where I was born in Piemonte, which is northern Italy, which is influenced, which was originally the kingdom of Savoy, and the which kind of encompassed a little bit of France and Italy at that time. So you take those two cuisines and you say they're both Italian, and then go, oh my gosh, they're nothing alike. They're not even close in some aspects. And you know, where northern Italy, you'll see a lot more butter being used, and you know, clearer sauces. That's where you're going to see a lot of that, salsa verde and that kind of agrodolce, but in a different way. You go down south, you're going to be more olive oil, more spice, and those kind of things. And then the agrodolce, the sweet and spicy, the sweet and tart down south, but with different things, whether it's different greens, more vinegar based versus other flavors that go in there. So it's really interesting to see the diversity of a country basically square mileage-wise smaller than New York State and the influence that that country has. And I get a little pride in that, that influence that the culinary part of that country has on the rest of the world. And our food has gone a long way. You know, and I'll never get into a conversation with a Frenchman about where this hot cuisine or the true essence of real fine cooking has come from. You'll never win the argument, no matter what side you're on.
Right, right.
So it's just one of those natural progressions. And the Italians have this thing that we may not have invented everything. You know, the pizza, the Syrians were doing flatbreads with toppings on it long before the Italians were making pizza, but we perfected it. You know, we took it, refined it, perfected it, exposed it to the rest of the world. So, but it's kind of fun. So when you're talking about a dish like the veal valdostana, basically a traditional Italian dish that you'll see, and again, it goes back to a cheese. Fontina cheese is a natural cheese for that that works well.
Great melter.
Yeah, great melting. And that's a great melting, great flavor, everything about it. Prosciutto, and then veal. You could do a veal scallopini. You could do a chicken, you could do pork, whatever. Here at the restaurant, we're doing about a 12-ounce veal chop. It's on the bone. I already get them boned, taken care of and set up for me from my purveyor. If you are lucky enough to find a good local place that raises veal, that's wonderful. If you're against eating veal, that's a whole nother show. I'm not going to hold.
Right.
I won't judge you if you don't judge me. There's nothing wrong with not wanting to eat the veal. That's when I say, go to chicken, go to a pork chop. Same thing,
right.
You dig out one of those bone-in pork chops. They're phenomenal for the valdostana. And then simply what I do is this. I take the chop.
So, Chef, I got to ask real quick, where within Italy is the valdostana region?
You're talking about the
northwestern
part of Italy. So it's closer up north. So, and that's where you're going to get a lot of this kind of creaminess from the you'll see a lot more of this cream sauce kind of feel. Now in the original valdostana, a nice mushroom cream sauce goes with it, and then you have the creamy cheese and all that. But I kind of changed it up a little bit. It can be breaded or unbreaded, but the recipe I'm going to give you, it's so simple. Like I said, you could do this around a chicken breast if you want to. So we take the veal chop itself, right? It's a 12-ounce veal chop, so they're pretty decently thick. I pound it out just a little bit. I'm not trying to get it too flat. I just want to make it even. Go towards the bone and make it even. Go up around, everything at the same level. That helps for your cooking, and that's a big thing. You know, we've cooked, whether it be a chicken breast, a lobe of chicken that is kind of off-size.
Right,
on one
right.
side, it's thinner. you know, the cooking time throws it off, and then it's some parts are a little drier than others. We don't want that. So I pan it a little bit, season it with some salt and pepper, and then I put some pieces of fontina cheese down on it. Now, if you go to a really good deli or you have someone that slices prosciutto really thin, you want thin-sliced, perfect slices of prosciutto, because then what you're going to do with that, about two of them wrap around what you just started. So from the bone to the meat, you're going to cover the fontina with some prosciutto. Then again, I take a little bit of whether wax paper or what's that called? The wrap paper, the film.
The
cling. Yeah. Wow. The culinary terms are getting away from me. You take that, you put it on top. You then pound your prosciutto and fontina back in, but gingerly. You just want to get it so that they kind of adhere to the skin, right, or adhere to the meat. Now, with that, now I don't add any flour or anything to this dish. You can. A little bit of flour on each side will allow it not to stick in the pan if you're worried about how it's going to cook. So then I would say, let's go with flour. You're going to dredge it lightly in flour, and then make sure you pat a little bit dry. So you have the prosciutto, well, you have the meat, the fontina, the prosciutto wrapped around it, and then a little bit of flour, a hot pan with oil. You want to get it to kind of smoking, but not super smoking where it's going to burn the oil or burn the prosciutto itself. So, and then you're going to sear for about 4 to 5 minutes on one side. No, 3 to 4 minutes. Sorry about that. 3 to 4 minutes on one side. Flip it over, sear it on the other. And then 8 minutes in the oven, 350-degree oven for 8 minutes. It's going to come out pretty done in that medium well stage. I cook mine a little bit less because I like pink veal. But yeah. I also know that, you know, I've told that to people and I usually get that cringe look. So
now I'm with you. And I think this is a sort of an educational point here because you hit on one of my pet peeves. That we really need to educate for me, and I think from what you've said, speaking for you as well, and correct me if I'm wrong, the veal should have what I call a pink blush, and so should pork. And the origin of sort of really cooking that pork and really drying it out goes way back in history when pigs were allowed to wander the city streets, essentially, mm-hmm. and they ate garbage, not when they were in the forest, etc. Because of really those unsanitary types of rearing methods, of which really nobody gets their pork that way now, there was a risk of a disease called trichinosis, which was a very horrible, painful disease should you get it. And if you cooked the pork very well done, you would heat it to the point where you would not get this parasite. And so that's sort of where through history, the recommendations, the need at one time in history to really overcook your meats beyond what we would find palatable, certainly I do today, comes from. But we don't need to do that anymore because of the quality and fortunately, you know, the healthful inspection regulations in terms of the food supply. You don't have to worry about that. So, you know, where they used to say, and you'll still see it today, right, where they're saying, you know, take your pork to like 170 or something. You know, I'm serving mine, you know, way down. I'm pulling it at 140. Letting it the carryover heat to 145, and it shouldn't be pink. It's not like a medium rare steak, but it should just have just a little blush, like you went and you just took a little rouge and, you know, dressed up your meat.
Right, and that's important. It'll be tender, it'll
juicy.
Be juicy, and I think that's the biggest thing. The worst thing you could do is dry it out. Now, what's great about the process that I'm showing. That I'm doing with the prosciutto and the fontina cheese, in a lot of ways, that prosciutto protects the meat from drying out, and it's done that for us almost every night. I know there was one time that my chef had left it in the oven a little too long one night, and pulled it out. He goes, "I don't know if I should serve this." I said, "Well, that's all right. Just make another one, and I'll eat it." And I thought it was going to be really dry. I didn't get to eat it till the end of service, and it was still moist, and it wasn't completely overcooked anyway. I was like, wow.
Well, you've
this
also
stuff
got
is
that.
Good.
You've got that fontina, which is essentially a layer of fat. You've got that dairy fat under the prosciutto. So, like you said, basically, you've got a skin, And then you, it's like, you know, putting maybe butter or fat, you know, under the skin of that chicken to really keep it from drying out when you're doing a roast chicken. And you're exactly. essentially accomplishing
creating
the
that,
same
yeah.
thing. Yeah. And really, I mean, perfectly done, crispy skin, you know, whole bone in chicken breast. I mean, to me, a perfectly roast chicken and getting that cut with that, you know, that skin and the juicy chicken is just, that's a dinner. That's a classic. And you're helping us recreate this with what could be, as you point out, a cut that really dries out quickly.
Yeah, and it's absolutely wonderful to do. It is, veal chops themselves can be a little more expensive cut. One of the things I would tell you, if you find a butcher that can do this for you or creates this, there are, when you look at a veal chop, it has these perfect bones throughout. There's always that last chop itself that's a little more on the fatty side, slash never perfect. If you could get your butcher to save you some of those, you want to do a dinner with that, they'll cost you half the price, and they're worth it because they taste phenomenal. That was just a little side thing. You could go into your butcher right now and tell them, and they'll be like, what?
Those are the great tips, you know, that folks need. Because as you said, you know, food is expensive. You know, good, high-quality proteins like we're talking about sourcing, and you and I have spent whole shows talking about sourcing, you know, they do cost more. So what are some of the tricks and tips that chefs use to source? You just gave us one, because the appearance of this chop doesn't matter because it's going to be wrapped in prosciutto. So right. you can get something that's all flavor. But, you know, but you're not worried about the appearance. The same thing, you know, if I'm going to my fishmonger and I'm doing, you know, blackened fish tacos, I can get grouper cheeks that are $6 or $8 a pound because right. I don't need to tear up and shred fillets that are $25 a pound.
Exactly.
So, that's great, great, great. Thank you, Chef. That's a great, great tip.
Well, that's because I'm frugal. I used to call myself cheap, and then I realized as I got older, it's not being cheap; it's being smart and frugal.
Well, you and I have run professional kitchens, and you have to be, because when you're working with a natural product like food in a kitchen, there's natural waste, there's natural spoilage. Things are going to happen, and your margins, you know, despite what folks are thinking, oh, you know, I'm paying, you know, $30 for this dish. Boy, this restaurant must be making, you know, just a fortune.
Exactly.
You know, we're not. You know, the cost of the food, the cost of the labor, the cost of the overhead is tremendous. And when you've got a restaurant like yours that is serving us real food, you know, not the you know, mass produced, the semi pulls up at the back, you know, and
right.
dumps off processed junk once a week. And you're really feeding us delicious and healthful food. Well, you know, those cost more, folks. You know, you didn't think it's not worth it when you dine out. You know, come see me and wait till you get the bill for an angioplasty. That'll be a hell of a lot more. You know, but you know, and not near as delicious. But you know, you and I have run those kitchens, so these are things that you can put into your home kitchen. So like a chef, because I really talk about this a lot in the new book coming up. It's you know, it's probably maybe a third of the book. We talk about the art of sorcery, you know, as part of, you know, being a food shaman and part of being a chef, and going out there and using the tips and techniques that you're sharing with us. And that's what makes the difference between good and great. And healthful and unhealthful. So really, you know, a tip of the chef's hat for you. Thanks for sharing that.
My pleasure, man. So let's tell everybody a little bit about what's coming up in the next couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So what we've got coming up on November 16th is I'm going to be at Chef Luca's Mediterranean Cafe as part. I guess we'll actually be at the culinary arena, which I'm really hoping is like Thunderdome, like, you know, six chef enters, three chefs leave sort of thing. You know, I'm expecting the Tina Turner, you know, entrance. And I'm hoping now I think we should make them cook in chainmail. Oh, my
gosh. Yeah, I think you're confusing me with the next evolution of Food Network competition shows, my friend.
I think we just gave them an idea.
You know what? I would be surprised if that hasn't been pitched at some point. Do we let them go in and fight their way out? Or it's not about the food? Yeah, that's exactly what's next. But we're doing what's called Keen Top Chef. It's our community edition, where we are our competitors. Generally, let's just do a little backtrack for people who haven't heard yet. Generally, we do a competition that benefits what's called Culinary Journeys. It's my nonprofit organization that is to benefit students and young professionals in their own culinary journey and how we can help them out, whether through scholarships, whether through helping them with equipment, with more education, even if it's not on the higher, you know, college level, we could do whatever, and also helping our local culinary programs here in Keene. So ultimately, that's our goal as an organization. I started this with a bunch of really incredible people, local young chef and some incredible people that wanted to get involved with me and help me pursue this goal and dream. And we've been putting on Top Chef events, which are basically what's it called? Oh, Iron Chef and Chopped kind of
Chopped
come together for this big mashup of local chefs. So we put an event together, and we also have a community version. The community version is great because last year the fire department versus the police department, and this year we have doctors versus nurses, November 16th. It's a Thursday night. It's going to be at the Cheshire Career Room in Keene, and our guest chef judge is none other than Dr. Michael Fenster. Sir, I am honored to have you here as a guest judge.
I am honored. I'm excited. You know, Keene is such a beautiful place in New Hampshire this time of year. So, you know, folks, if you're in the area, definitely come on by. You know, stay for the weekend. Enjoy the wonderful. These guys know how to do fall. Lots of activities, lots of beautiful, you know, fall colors. You know, as we're winding down fall this time of the year, great to see. We're actually, you and I are going to be doing an event that will highlight sort of a sneak peek of my upcoming book, Food Shaman, the day before at your restaurant. So folks can come get a copy, signed copy of Ancient Eats, my latest book. We'll give a sneak peek about Food Shaman. We'll do some one-on-one, some talking. We're also going to get a great meal from you and your staff. So, you know, come on up on that Wednesday and stay through the weekend. Make a little mini vacation out of it. If you're in the city, upstate New York, Connecticut, you know, it's a Boston, right? It's a simple drive up there. I think you'll have a blast.
They'll have a great time. And if you want to get more information, you can look us up on Facebook or also our Lucas Ved Cafe or lucascafe.com. But more importantly, just give a call to the restaurant, 358-3335. It's 603-358-3335, and ask for me, and I'll walk you through what's the best way to get over here. And if you want to buy tickets to either the show with you as our guest judge or the dinner with you as our guest chef or both, just contact me, and I'll tell you how to make that happen. And it'll be a good time. It definitely will be a good time.
Yeah, it's going to be great. And actually, you'll be there with me for the dinner. So it'll sort of almost be like, you know, you'll get to come backstage on one of our culinary CPR episodes, you know, ask questions, see what we do, you know, get some insight. Like I said, I'm sharing first time anywhere in the country. The book will be out in early 2018. So this is the first time anywhere in the country you're going to get a sneak peek. We'll do a little reading, share a chapter from it, and really introduce what I think is a fascinating concept, and really a progression where I see kind of food going. It's called Food Shaman, the Art of Quantum Food. And I know you're saying, well, what the heck is quantum food? Show up at Lucas Mediterranean Cafe and you'll find out.
I'm pretty excited to see what the book's going to be about, because it's funny because what's old is new again sometimes, and you've had to go into the past to realize that that's the good stuff. And if we could bring all that kind of stuff back, we're going to be doing better, right?
Yeah, and actually, I'm finishing up for by next week. The manuscript is headed to the publisher, which is Post Hill Press out of New York City. Give those guys a shout out, because I got to tell you, I put the book on the market out there, and it didn't last a week, and these guys snapped it up. So I'm very excited to be working with them. They do a great job, and I've already got some you know great ideas. I think they're going to get a really fun, readable book. Ton of science in there. In fact, there's really sort of a whole separate chapter that's if for folks that are interested in getting the evidence base behind it. What we're talking about, but it's really, I think, what you and I share a passion for. And as I've had the pleasure to travel, and I think you have too, this country and this world, it's for folks that share a passion for the food experience. It's really kind of the art of eating. What is it? It's more than nutrition and ingredients, isn't it, that you and I love so much about? It's the shared food experience that I can't wait. The reason I'm excited to come with you is, you know, I'm sure the competition will be great. I want to sit down and have some food and a glass of wine with you. You know, it's been too long since we did that.
I think that's the reason why people do get together, and that's why food is so great. And cultures like, you know, growing up in my family, food wasn't just something that fed us. It was part of every event and everything we did, and it was kind of the centerpiece of everything. And it was the reason why people got together, and it's the reason why families were so, you know, centralized, and they all wanted to visit each other. It's revolved around food. So it's bigger than just a way to feed our bodies. It feeds our souls, and it makes us better people.
And I think what we're finding out and what the book will talk about is all the things you just said are not, you know, small, unimportant details. It turns out that when we look beyond nutrition into this whole food experience and the way it affects us as only it can as human beings, that this is very powerful medicine, very powerful medicine, and a way to empower ourselves to not only heal ourselves, but have healthy, wonderful lives for ourselves and all those that we care about. And Chef, I can't wait to get up there and see you. And until I see you at Chef Luca's Mediterranean Cafe on November 15th and 16th for the reading and the program, may the only pain in your life, my friends, be champagne.